Similarly, Bangladesh CFR, Senegal, Pakistan, Serbia, Nigeria, Turkey, and Ukraine all allow unrestricted use of HCQ, and all have minuscule case fatality rates compared to the countries that ban HCQ. Wealthier democracies or countries with especially restrictive HCQ protocols, Ireland, Canada, Spain, the Netherlands, UK, Belgium, and France, are comparatively deadly environments. Andrew Schlafly observed that the mortality rate from COVID-19 in countries that allow access to HCQ is only one-tenth the mortality rate in countries where there is interference with this medication, such as the United States. In some areas of Central America, officials are even going door-to-door to distribute HCQ. These countries have been successful in limiting the mortality from COVID-19 to only a fraction of what it is in wealthier countries. As the industry-government cartel ramped up its campaign to keep HCQ from the masses, many doctors fought back. On July 23rd, Yale virologist Dr. Harvey Riche persisted, this time with a Newsweek article titled, "The Key to Defeating COVID-19 Already Exists. We Need to Start Using It." Dr. Riche beseeched the authorities. HCQ saves lives, and its use could quickly end the pandemic. By then, Dr. Riche had updated his rigorous analysis of the early treatment of COVID-19 with hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and azithromycin. He now cited 12 clinical studies suggesting that the early administration of HCQ could lower death rates by 50%. In that case, COVID-19 would have a lower case fatality rate than the seasonal influenza. "We would still have had a pandemic," Harvey Riche told me, "but we wouldn't have had the carnage." Noting more than 50 HCQ studies, Dr. Merrill Nass in June 2020 supported Riche's calculation. If people were treated prophylactically with this drug, using only 2 tablets weekly, as is done in some areas and some occupational groups in India, there would probably be at least 50% fewer cases after exposure. Stopping the pandemic in its tracks seemed to be the last thing Tony Fauci wanted. Thanks to Dr. Fauci, most U.S. states had by then banned treatment with HCQ, including Dr. Nass's home state of Maine, which banned it for prophylaxis, but did allow it for acute treatment. Dr. Nass suggested that the acts to suppress the use of HCQ were carefully orchestrated, and that these events might have been planned to keep the pandemic going, to sell expensive drugs and vaccines to a captive population. In the same article by Dr. Merrill Nass, published on June 27, 2020, Nass, who has extensively studied HCQ, pointed out that with prophylactic treatment with HCQ at the onset of their illness, over 99% would quickly resolve the infection, avoiding progression to the late-stage disease characterized by cytokine storm, thrombophilia, and organ failure. Despite claims to the contrary, this treatment is very safe, yet outpatient treatment is banned in the United States. Beginning June 27, 2020, Dr. Nass began a list of deceptive strategies that the Fauci Pharma Gates cartel used to control the narrative on hydroxychloroquine and deny Americans access to this effective remedy. The list has grown to 58 separate strategies. "It is remarkable," she observed, "how a large series of events taking place over the past months produced a unified message about hydroxychloroquine and produced similar policies about the drug in the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Western Europe. The message is that generic, inexpensive hydroxychloroquine, costing only $1 to produce a full course, is dangerous." Dr. Fauci's hypocritical HCQ games. In his early AIDS days, Dr. Fauci had thrashed FDA as inhumane for demanding randomized double-blind placebo studies at the height of the pandemic. Now, here he was doing what he had condemned by blocking an effective treatment simply because it would compete with his expensive, patent-protected pharmaceutical, remdesivir, and vaccines. Dr. Fauci repeatedly insisted he would not allow HCQ for COVID-19 until its efficacy is proven in randomized, double-blind placebo studies. Dr. Risch calls this position a transparent sham. Dr. Fauci knew that neither industry nor its PIs would ever sponsor trials for a product with expired patents. It's noteworthy that while Dr. Fauci was bemoaning the lack of evidence of HCQ efficacy, he was refusing to commission his own trials to study early use of the hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and Zithromax remedy. Dr. Fauci himself, while spending $48 billion on zero-liability vaccines, at first refused to allocate anything for a randomized placebo study of HCQ. Even worse, he canceled two NIAID-sponsored trials of outpatient HCQ before completion. Dr. Fauci's hypocrisy about HCQ is evident to anyone who looks at his vacillating pronouncements throughout his long career. He has persistently insisted on double-blind, randomized placebo trials for medicines he dislikes, those that compete with his patented remedies, and airily fixed the NIAID study of remdesivir by changing the endpoints midstream to favor the drug. Dr. Fauci did not sponsor or encourage randomized trials for masks, lockdowns, or social distancing. And in the decades since he took over NIAID, he has never demanded randomized studies to confirm safety of the combined 69 vaccine doses currently on the childhood schedule. Every one of these vaccines is regarded as so unavoidably unsafe, in the words of the 1986 Vaccine Act, NCVIA, and the Supreme Court, that their manufacturers have demanded and received immunity from liability. During a 2013 USA Today interview, Dr. Fauci discussed remedies for another deadly coronavirus, MERS, which was causing an outbreak in Qatar and Saudi Arabia with over 30% mortality. Dr. Fauci then sang an entirely different tune than he is singing now, about hydroxychloroquine. He suggested using a combination of the antiviral drugs ribavirin and interferon alpha-2b to treat MERS, even though the treatment had never been tested for safety or effectiveness against MERS in humans. In that circumstance, Dr. Fauci's NIAID had found that the treatment could stop MERS virus from reproducing in lab-grown cells. And oh yes, NIAID had patented it. We don't have to start designing new drugs, Dr. Fauci told journalists. The next time someone comes into an emergency room in Qatar or Saudi Arabia, you would have drugs that are readily available, and at least you would have some data. Even though the treatment hadn't gone through any trials, Dr. Fauci urged its compassionate use. If I were a physician in a hospital and someone were dying, rather than do nothing, you can see if these work. He played by all new rules when it came to COVID, forcing doctors to stand on the sidelines while patients died and prohibiting them from trying combinations of repurposed therapeutics to see if these work. Back in 2013, when Dr. Fauci endorsed ribavirin interferon for use against MERS, the two-punch hepatitis C remedy was, according to NIH, horrendously dangerous, with harms occurring in literally every patient who took the concoction. It causes hemolytic anemia chronic fatigue syndrome, and a retinue of birth defects and or death of unborn children. Ribavirin is genotoxic, mutagenic, and a potential carcinogen. Nevertheless, in 2013, Dr. Fauci advocated the therapy despite the total lack of randomized placebo-controlled clinical trials. In fact, the lack of any human data on using the combination against MERS. The COVID vaccines that qualified for emergency use authorization include novel platforms like mRNA and DNA with no known safety profile. Others use toxic adjuvants like squalene and aluminum, or novel adjuvants with proven risks and potentially high rates of serious injuries. The 2-month randomized clinical trials that justified the EUAs for COVID vaccines were far too brief to detect injuries with longer incubation periods. The vaccines are so risky that the insurance industry has refused to underwrite them, and the manufacturers refuse to produce them without blanket immunity from liability. Bill Gates, who is the principal investor in many of these new COVID vaccines, stipulated that their risk is so great that he would not provide them to people unless every government shielded him from lawsuits. Why then should HCQ be the only remedy required to cross this artificially high hurdle? After all, HCQ is less in need of randomized placebo studies than any of these vaccines or remdesivir. The safety of HCQ has been established over more than 6 decades. While vaccines are given to healthy people who face small risk of catching the disease, HCQ is administered to people who are actually sick, with virtually no risk to the patient. If a drug is safe and might work, if people are dying and there are no other good options, must we not try it? Dr. Fauci's on-again, off-again interest in drug safety is situational and self-interested. He claimed on July 31st about HCQ that if that randomized placebo-controlled trial shows efficacy, I would be the first to admit it and to promote it, but I have not. So I just have to go with the data. I don't have any horse in the game one way or the other. I just look at the data. In fact, Dr. Fauci always had a stable of horses in the game. One of them is remdesivir. Even after the WHO's randomized placebo trial showed remdesivir ineffective against COVID. Furthermore, remdesivir has a catastrophic safety profile. His second nag is the Moderna vaccine, in which he invested years and $6 billion taxpayer dollars. He was thrilled to sponsor a human trial of a Moderna COVID vaccine, partly owned by his agency, before there were any safety and efficacy data from animal studies, which goes against FDA regulations. He then pushed for hundreds of millions of people to get EUA vaccines before the randomized placebo-controlled trials were complete. So much for Dr. Fauci's requirement for having high-quality evidence before risking use of drugs and vaccines in humans. Dr. Fauci's ethical flip-flopping about the need for rigid safety testing is particularly troubling, since he is championing a competitive product from which his agency and his employees expect a lucrative financial outcome. In the midst of a pandemic, with hundreds of thousands of deaths attributed to COVID, and the economy in free fall, Dr. Fauci's suggestion that we withhold promising treatments that have an established safety profile from patients who have a potentially lethal disease, pending the completion of randomized controlled clinical trials, is highly manipulative and utterly unethical. It is not medically ethical to allow a COVID-19 patient to deteriorate in the early stages of the infection when there is an inexpensive, safe, and demonstrably effective HCQ treatment that CDC's and NIAID's own studies show blocks coronavirus replication. It would be equally unethical to enroll sick individuals in such studies, as Dr. Fauci proposes, in which half the infected patients would receive a placebo. Dr. Fauci's hypocrisy is particularly acute since the 21st Century Cures Act, which Congress passed in 2016, directs the FDA to accept precisely the type of real-world evidence reported by treating physicians like Drs. Zelenko, Raoult, Riche, Corey, McCullough, Gold, and Chinese doctors in lieu of controlled clinical trials for licensing new products. The Cures Act recognizes that doctors and scientists can obtain very useful information when treating patients and observing the results outside of a formal trial setting. For Big Pharma, no milestone was more important during the current pandemic than neutralizing HCQ to prevent its widespread beneficial use. Dr. Fauci's shocking inconsistency and ethical breaches are congruent with his long history of promoting Big Pharma's more profitable patented products and using his power and influence to advance its agenda without regard to public health. Dr. Fauci's leadership role in this deadly scandal is consistent with his long history of discrediting therapies that compete with vaccines and other patented pharmaceutical products. Thanks to Dr. Fauci's strategic campaign, most Americans are still unable to obtain HCQ for early treatment of COVID-19. Even fewer Americans are able to access it as preventive medicine, and fewer still are aware of its benefits. His bizarre and inexplicable actions give credence to the suspicions held by many Americans that Dr. Fauci is working to prolong the epidemic in order to impose expensive patented drugs and vaccines on a captive population during a pandemic that has crashed the world economy, caused famines, and destroyed lives. While Dr. Fauci held us hostage waiting for what turned out to be imperfect vaccines, his own agency attributed over 500,000 deaths in America to COVID. Professor Riche believes that Dr. Fauci knowingly lied about the drugs hydroxychloroquine and used his influence to get the FDA to suppress it because he and other bureaucrats are in bed with other forces that are causing them to make decisions that are not based on the science and are killing Americans. Moreover, Dr. Riche specifically claims that Fauci and the FDA have caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans who could have been saved by HCQ. 3. Ivermectin. By the summer of 2020, frontline physicians had discovered another COVID remedy that equaled HCQ in its staggering, life-saving efficacy. 5 years earlier, two Merck scientists won the Nobel Prize for developing ivermectin, IVM, a drug with unprecedented firepower against a wide range of human parasites, including roundworm, hookworm, river blindness, and lymphatic filariasis. That salute was the Nobel Committee's only award to an infectious disease medication in 60 years. FDA approved IVM as safe and effective for human use in 1996. WHO includes IVM, along with HCQ, on its inventory of essential medicines, its list of remedies so necessary, safe, efficacious, and affordable that WHO deems easy access to them as essential to satisfy the priority healthcare needs of the population. WHO has recommended administering ivermectin to entire populations to treat people who might have parasitic infections, meaning they consider it safe enough to give to people who haven't even been diagnosed. Millions of people have consumed billions of IVM doses as an anti-parasitic with minimal side effects. Ivermectin's package insert suggests that it is at least as safe as the most popular over-the-counter medications, including Tylenol and aspirin. Researchers at Japan's Kitasato Institute published a 2011 paper describing IVM in terms almost never used for any other drug. There are few drugs that can seriously lay claim to the title of wonder drug, penicillin and aspirin being two that have perhaps had greatest beneficial impact on the health and well-being of mankind. But ivermectin can also be considered alongside those worthy contenders based on its versatility, safety, and the beneficial impact that it has had and continues to have worldwide, especially on hundreds of millions of the world's poorest people. Three statues at the Carter Center, at the headquarters of the World Bank, and at the headquarters of the World Health Organization honor the development of ivermectin. Because since 2012, multiple in vitro studies have demonstrated that IVM inhibits the replication of a wide range of viruses. Nature magazine published a 2020 study reviewing 50 years of research, finding IVM highly effective against microorganisms, including some viruses, and reporting the results in animal studies demonstrating antiviral effects of ivermectin in viruses such as Zika, dengue, yellow fever, West Nile. An April 3, 2020 article entitled "Lab Experiments Show Antiparasitic Drug Ivermectin Eliminates SARS-CoV-2 in Cells in 48 Hours" by Australian researchers at Monash and Melbourne Universities and the Royal Melbourne Hospital first won IVM global attention as a potential treatment for COVID. The international press initially raved that this safe, inexpensive, well-known, and readily available drug had demolished SARS-CoV-2 in cell cultures. We found that even a single dose could essentially remove all viral RNA by 48 hours, and that even at 24 hours there was a really significant reduction in it, said lead researcher Dr. Kylie Wagstaff. Based on this study, on May 8, 2020, Peru, then under siege by a crushing COVID endemic, adopted ivermectin in its national guidelines. Peruvian doctors already knew the medicine, widely prescribed it for parasites, and health authorities knew it was safe and were comfortable with it, recalls Dr. Pierre Corey. COVID deaths dropped precipitously, by 14-fold, in the regions where the Peruvian government effectively distributed ivermectin. Reductions in deaths correlated with the extent of IVM distributions in all 25 states. In December 2020, Peru's new president, under pressure from WHO, severely restricted IVM availability, and COVID cases rebounded with deaths increasing 13-fold. In prophylaxis studies, ivermectin repeatedly demonstrated far greater efficacy against COVID than vaccines at a fraction of the cost. In Argentina, for example, in the summer of 2020, Dr. Hector Carvalho conducted a randomized placebo-controlled trial of ivermectin as a preventative, finding 100% efficacy against COVID. Carvalho's team found no infections among the 788 workers who took weekly ivermectin prophylaxis, whereas 58% of the 407 controls had become ill with COVID-19. A later observational study from Bangladesh, also investigating ivermectin as a pre-exposure prophylaxis against COVID-19 among healthcare workers, found nearly as spectacular results. Only 4 of the 58 volunteers who took a minimal dose of ivermectin, 12 milligrams once per month for 4 months, developed mild COVID-19 symptoms, compared to 44 of the 60 healthcare workers who had declined the medication. Furthermore, a 2021 study suggested that a key biological mechanism of IVM, competitive binding with SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, was not specific to any coronavirus variant, and therefore, unlike vaccines, ivermectin would probably be effective against all future variants. As early as March 1, 2020, some frontline ICU and ER doctors began using ivermectin in combination with HCQ in early treatment protocols. Dr. Jean-Jacques Ryder, a Belgian physician working in Miami, began using the drug March 15th and immediately saw an uptick in recoveries. He published an excellent paper on June 9th. Meanwhile, two Western physicians using ivermectin in Bangladesh also reported a very high rate of recoveries, even among patients in later states of illness. Since March 2020, when doctors first used IVM against COVID-19, more than 20 randomized clinical trials, RCTs, have confirmed its miraculous efficacy against COVID for both inpatient and outpatient treatment. 6 of 7 meta-analyses of IVM treatment RCTs completed in 2021 found notable reductions in COVID-19 mortality. The relevant studies all showed significant benefit for high-risk outpatients, says the eminent Yale epidemiologist Dr. Harvey Riche. The only studies where its performance was anything short of stellar were those that investigated its efficacy in patients in very late stages of COVID. But even late-stage patients showed benefits in almost all studies, although somewhat less dramatic. According to a 2020 review by McCullough et al., numerous clinical studies, including peer-reviewed randomized controlled trials, showed large magnitude benefits of ivermectin in prophylaxis, early treatment, and also in late-stage disease management. Taken together, dozens of clinical trials that have now emerged from around the world are substantial enough to reliably assess clinical efficacy and infer a signal of benefit with acceptable safety. Early in January 2021, Dr. David Chesler, a geriatric specialist who had treated 191 infected patients since the previous spring at 7 Virginia nursing homes, wrote to Dr. Fauci, claiming that he had achieved a mortality rate of 8% using ivermectin, half and 146,000 deaths less than the U.S. average in elder care facilities. In his letter to Dr. Fauci, Chesler attached a peer-reviewed case study documenting reports of similar efficacy from other countries. Neither Dr. Fauci nor anyone else from NIAID replied to Dr. Chesler's letter. The Annals of Dermatology and Venereology reported that in a French nursing home, all 69 residents, average age 90, and 52 staff survived a COVID-19 outbreak. As it turns out, they had all taken ivermectin for a scabies infestation. COVID decimated the surrounding community, but only 7 elder home residents and 4 staff were affected, and all had mild illness. None required oxygen or hospitalization. Research suggests that ivermectin may work through as many as 20 separate mechanisms. Among them, ivermectin functions as an ionophore, facilitating transfer of zinc into the cells, which inhibits viral replication. Ivermectin stops replication of COVID-19, seasonal flu, and many other viruses through this and other mechanisms. For example, a March 2021 study by Chudery et al. Found that ivermectin was found as a blocker of viral replicase, protease, and human TMPRSS2, which could be the biophysical basis behind its antiviral efficiency. The drug also reduces inflammation via multiple pathways, thereby protecting against organ damage. Ivermectin furthermore impairs the spike protein's ability to attach to the ACE2 receptor on human cell membranes, preventing viral entry. Moreover, the drug prevents blood clots through binding to spike protein and also deters the spike protein from binding to CD147 on red blood cells, which would otherwise trigger clumping. When patients take IVM before exposure, the drug prevents infection, which halts onward transmission and helps protect the entire community. In March 2021, a published study by Peter McCullough and 57 other frontline physicians from multiple countries found that our early ambulatory treatment regimen was associated with estimated 87.6% and 74.9% reductions in hospitalization and death. Many other studies echo Dr. McCullough's results. The average reduction in mortality, based on 18 trials, is 75%, according to a January 2021 meta-analysis presentation to the NIH COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel. A WHO-sponsored meta-review of 11 studies likewise suggests ivermectin can reduce COVID-19 mortality by as much as 83%. On average, used prophylactically, ivermectin prevented 86% of the adverse outcomes. Over all these studies, ivermectin protected 6 of every 7 people who used it to prevent COVID. And of 29 studies of early treatment of COVID using ivermectin, the average benefit was 66%. Graphs and tables reflecting the data discussed here can be found on the ivmmeta.org website. They are part of a much larger website that has compiled all completed, validated studies for each of 27 different treatments for COVID-19 at c19study.com. A January 2021 study in The Lancet found that ivermectin dramatically reduced the intensity and duration of symptoms and viral loading. In March 2020, Dr. Paul Merrick, Chief of Intensive Care Medicine at Eastern Virginia Medical School, began posting treatment guidelines for the care of COVID patients. Dr. Merrick, one of the best-known and well-published professors of intensive care medicine, recruited a team of the most highly respected and most published leading ICU physicians from across the globe to systematically research all possible approaches to this new virus. Soon, his organization, Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, FLCCC, created a website and posted their first treatment protocols in mid-April 2020. By November 2020, the FLCCC doctors felt there was enough evidence to add ivermectin to their protocols. The data show the ability of the drug ivermectin to prevent COVID-19, to keep those with early symptoms from progressing to the hyperinflammatory phase of the disease, and even to help critically ill patients recover. Peer reviewers green-lighted the clinical and scientific rationale for FLCCC's hospital protocols, and the Journal of Intensive Care Medicine published them in mid-December 2020. FLCCC also published on its website a one-page summary, regularly updated, of the clinical trial evidence for ivermectin. In December 2020, FLCCC President and Chief Medical Officer Dr. Pierre Corey, a pulmonary and critical care specialist, testified to the benefits of ivermectin before a number of COVID-19 panels, including the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. In riveting testimony, Corey described 6 studies with a total of over 2,400 patients, all showing near-perfect prevention of transmission of this virus in people exposed to COVID-19. 3 RCTs, randomized control studies, and multiple large case series involving over 3,000 patients showing stunning recovery among hospitalized patients, and 4 large randomized control trials involving 3,000 patients, all showing large and statistically significant reductions in mortality when treated with ivermectin. 2 weeks later, on January 6, 2021, Dr. Corey spoke to the National Institutes of Health COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel. Along with eminence grease Dr. Paul Merrick and other members of the frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance also presented positive data on ivermectin, as did the WHO's meta-analysis author, Dr. Andrew Hill, who they had invited to present with them. The Financial Times followed with an article citing Hill's research for the WHO at the University of Liverpool. Hill's meta-analysis of 6 ivermectin studies showed a cumulative 75% reduction of risk of death in a subset of moderate to severe COVID-19 patients in whom the drug reduced inflammation and sped up elimination of the virus. Corey testified that IVM could reduce hospitalizations by almost 90% and deaths by almost 75%. Corey is one of a multitude of leading frontline physicians, including McCullough, Florida's Surgeon General Joe Latipo, Professor Paul Merrick, Dr. Joseph Varone, and mRNA vaccine inventor Dr. Robert Malone, and many, many others who believe that early treatment with ivermectin would have avoided 75 to 80% of deaths and saved our country $1 trillion in treasure. COVID resulted in 6 million hospitalizations and 700,000 plus deaths in America, says Dr. Corey. If HCQ and IVM had been widely used instead of systematically suppressed, we could have prevented 75% or at least 500,000 deaths and 80% of hospitalizations or 4.8 million. We could have spared the states hundreds of billions of dollars. 10 days after the FLCCC presentation on January 14th, the NIH's COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel changed its previously negative recommendation to doctors regarding ivermectin to neither for nor against, cracking open the door just a little for physicians to use IVM as a therapeutic option. That is the same neutral recommendation the NIH committee members gave for monoclonal antibody and convalescent plasma treatments. Although the hopes were that both of these latter treatments would be effective when used early, convalescent plasma, a favorite of nearly all academic medical centers in the country, failed miserably to show efficacy in numerous clinical trials, said Dr. Corey, while monoclonal antibodies did prove effective in preventing hospitalization. NIH's neutral January 14, 2021 non-recommendation, issued in the face of strong evidence of ivermectin's safety and efficacy for COVID-19, was the first obvious signal of the agency's determination to suppress IVM. NIH claimed that there was insufficient evidence to recommend either for or against the use of ivermectin for the treatment of COVID-19. NIH shrouded its process for reaching that non-recommendation in secrecy, refusing to disclose the panel members who took part in the ivermectin deliberations and redacting their names from the documents that various Freedom of Information Act requests compelled the agency to produce. For a time, only Dr. Fauci, Francis Collins, and the panelists themselves knew their identities. NIH took extreme measures to keep the name secret, fighting all the way into federal court to shield the proceedings from transparency. As Collins and Dr. Fauci maneuvered to shade the process from sunlight, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in response to a separate FOIA request, disclosed the group's 9 members. 3 members of the working group, Adora Adimora, Roger Bedimo, and David V. Glidden, had disclosed financial relationships with Merck. A 4th member of the NIH Guidelines Committee, Susanna Nagy, received a $155 million grant to conduct further studies of ivermectin following the NIH non-recommendation. NIAID's windfall payoff to Nagy would have been unlikely to go forward if the committee voted to approve IVM. Today, as Dr. Fauci moves the U.S. to eliminate all use of ivermectin, other countries are using more of it. In February 2021, the head of the Tokyo Metropolitan Medical Association held a press conference to call for adding ivermectin to its outpatient treatment protocol. Several Indian states had added ivermectin to their list of essential medicines to fight COVID-19. Indonesia's government not only authorized the use of the drug, but also created a website showing its real-time availability. After giving out third booster doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, but still seeing high rates of COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths, Israel started using ivermectin officially in September 2021, with the health insurance companies distributing ivermectin to high-risk citizens. El Salvador distributes IVM for free to all of its citizens. Nations whose residents have easy access to ivermectin invariably see immediate and dramatic declines in COVID deaths. Hospitals in Indonesia started using ivermectin on July 22, 2021. By the first week of August, cases and deaths were plummeting. A December 2020 study showed that African and Asian countries that widely used ivermectin to treat and prevent various parasitic diseases enjoy some of the world's lowest reported COVID case and mortality rates. After controlling for confounding factors, including the Human Development Index, HDI, the 11 African nations with membership in the African Program for Onchocerciasis, aka river blindness, for which ivermectin is standard of care, APOC show 28% lower mortality than non-APOC African countries and an 8% lower rate of COVID-19 infection. On April 20, 2021, India's medical societies added ivermectin to the national protocol. According to Indian and international news, an aggressive campaign by the government of the Indian state of New Delhi, where COVID was raging, showed stunning success. The Desert Review reported that in April 2021, New Delhi was experiencing a COVID epidemic crisis. The state government obliterated 97% of Delhi cases by distributing ivermectin. IVM crushed COVID in New Delhi, wrote Dr. Justice R. Hope, M.D. Following IVM's introduction, according to Trial Site News, cases dropped dramatically. At the national level, the massive surge that overtook the country at the beginning of April slowed exponentially after the new COVID-19 protocol was introduced, which includes the use of ivermectin and budesonide. India showed that early combination therapy, budesonide, ivermectin, doxycycline, and zinc, costing between $2 and $5, made COVID symptoms disappear within 3 to 5 days. By January 2021, a country of more than 1.3 billion people and a vaccine uptake of almost 7.6% nationally had witnessed only 150,000 COVID deaths. By comparison, the U.S., with a population of 331 million, had recorded 357,000 deaths. Many Indian officials and doctors consider ivermectin a miracle drug for controlling the outbreak. A natural experiment involving two Indian states, Uttar Pradesh and Tamil Nadu, with opposite COVID strategies helped cement that impression. With 241 million people, Uttar Pradesh has the equivalent of 2/3 of the United States population. According to the Indian Express, Uttar Pradesh was the first state in the country to introduce large-scale prophylactic and therapeutic use of ivermectin. In May through June 2020, a team at Agra, Uttar Pradesh's fourth-largest city, led by Dr. Anshul Parikh, administered ivermectin to all RRT team members in the district on an experimental basis. None of them developed COVID-19. Despite being in daily contact with patients who had tested positive for the virus. Uttar Pradesh State Surveillance Officer Viksendu Agrawal added that, based on the findings from Agra, the state government sanctioned the use of ivermectin as a prophylactic for all the contacts of COVID patients and began administering doses to infected persons. By September, the Uttar Pradesh government announced that the state's 33 districts are virtually devoid of active cases, despite having a vaccination rate of only 5.8%. The Hindustan Times reported, overall, the state has a total of 199 active cases, while the positivity rate came down to less than 0.01%. The recovery rate, meanwhile, has improved to 98.7%. When America's vaccination rate was at 54%, cases were still rising and governments were still imposing draconian restrictions. As of August 10, 2021, the United States saw 161,990 new cases and 1,049 new deaths. Uttar Pradesh, in contrast, saw only 19 new cases and one death, more than 1,000 times lower than the U.S. Dr. Agrawal attributes the timely introduction of ivermectin to ending the first COVID wave. Despite being the state with the largest population base and a high population density, we have maintained a relatively low positivity rate and cases per million of population. According to TrialSite News, despite the Indian government's success in using ivermectin and budesonide, the media hasn't shown interest in sharing this news. Instead, the comments continue to promote remdesivir as an effective drug, and the few media outlets that do refer to ivermectin call it an unproven medicine or an outdated treatment. It is as if there are two different treatment realities, one on the ground and one in the local health systems. Millions of patients are now receiving ivermectin, yet one would never know by the media topics. Meanwhile, the Indian state of Tamil Nadu continued using Anthony Fauci's protocol of administering remdesivir, outlawing ivermectin, and discouraging early treatment. According to the Indian Times, Tamil Nadu continues to experience cases and fatalities that perfectly match the U.S. catastrophe. The massive and overwhelming evidence in favor of ivermectin includes scientist Dr. Tess Lawry's highly regarded, peer-reviewed meta-analysis. Dr. Lawry assessed 15 trials, finding a cumulative benefit of IVM in reducing deaths of 62%. Although the data quality of the ivermectin for prevention studies was less strong, they showed that ivermectin prophylaxis reduced COVID infections by 86%. Dr. Lawry, a world-renowned data researcher and scientific consultant, is an iconic eminence among global public health scientists and agencies. The Desert Review has deemed her the conscience of medicine because of her reputation for competence, precision, and integrity. Lawry's consulting group, the Evidence-Based Medicine Consultancy Limited, performs the scientific reviews that develop and support guidelines for global public health agencies, including the WHO and European governments, as well as international scientific and health consortia like the Cochrane Collaboration. Her clients have included a retinue of virtually all the larger government regulators now involved in the suppression of IVM and other repurposed drugs. At the end of December 2000, Dr. Lawry happened on a YouTube video of Pierre Corey's Senate testimony on ivermectin. Her interest piqued. Dr. Lawry conducted a pragmatic, rapid review between Christmas and New Year's to validate the 27 studies from the medical literature that Corey cited, assessing each of them for quality and power. After a week, I realized it was a go. IVM's safety was well established as a widely used dewormer, she told me. I was startled by the magnitude of its benefits. Its efficacy against COVID was consistently clear in multiple studies. I thought that all these people were dying, and this was a moral obligation. This drug should have been rolled out. Dr. Lawrie dispatched an urgent letter to British Health Minister Matt Hancock on January 4th, with her rapid review attached. She never heard back from Hancock. But in a suspicious coincidence, someone leaked a meta-review by WHO researcher Andrew Hill to the Daily Mail. 3 days later, Hill posted a preprint of his study. In the 1 month since he testified enthusiastically beside Dr. Corey in favor of ivermectin before the January 13th NIH panel, Hill had made a neck-wrenching volte-face. Cumulatively, the 7 studies in Hill's original meta-review still showed a dramatic reduction in hospitalizations and deaths among patients receiving IVM. The leaked version of Hill's meta-review included all the same papers that formerly supported his gung-ho promotion of IVM as a miraculous cure for COVID. Hill had altered only his conclusions. Now he claimed that those studies comprised a low quality of evidence, and so although they yielded a highly positive result, Hill assigned the result a low certainty. He could then declare that WHO should not recommend IVM without first performing long-term, randomized, placebo-controlled studies that would require many months, if not longer. Someone got to him, suggests Corey. Someone sent him the memo. Andrew Hill has been captured by some really dark forces. On January 7th, Dr. Lawrie summarized the overwhelming evidence from her rapid review in a video directed at British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, urging him to break the logjam and roll out IVM immediately. Her video, says Dr. Corey, was absolutely convincing. She forwarded the video appeal to the British and South African prime ministers on January 7th. She heard nothing from either. On January 13th, 2021, Dr. Lawrie used her convening power to assemble an invitation-only symposium of 20 of the world's leading experts, including researchers, physicians, patient advocates, and government consultancy advisors, to review her meta-analysis and make evidence-based recommendations on the use of ivermectin to prevent and treat COVID-19. She called the conference the British Ivermectin Recommendation Development, or BIRD, study. Tess Lawrie did exactly what WHO should have done, says Dr. Corey. She made a thorough, open, and transparent review of all the scientific evidence. During the day-long conference, the conferees reviewed each study in Dr. Lawrie's rapid meta-review, agreeing that the evidence supported an immediate rollout. Before adjourning, Dr. Lawrie and the scientific panel committed to conducting a full-scale Cochrane-style meta-review of all the scientific literature. Due to the mortal urgencies, they pledged to reconvene in a much larger group on January 14th. In the meantime, Dr. Lawrie managed to reach Andrew Hill by phone on January 6th, 2 days after the Daily Mail leaked his meta-review. She informed him that some of the leading lights of science had agreed to collaborate on the Cochrane-style meta-review, and she proposed that Hill should join the effort as a collaborator. She offered to share her data with Hill, and after the call, she sent him her spreadsheets. Dr. Lawrie had coordinated many Cochrane reviews for WHO and was indisputably among the world's ranking experts in systematically reviewing study data. Dr. Lawrie invited Hill to co-author the Cochrane review and to attend the next BIRD meeting on January 13th. It was an exciting opportunity. Under normal circumstances, Hill should have pounced on this chance to serve as lead author with some of the world's most prestigious researchers in creating a professional, bulletproof, evidence-to-decision framework for the WHO. He was nevertheless non-committal. He did agree to review Dr. Lawrie's spreadsheet. Dr. Lawrie and her colleagues launched a marathon effort to conduct a brand new review of all published studies in the medical literature from scratch, assessing each for power and bias. She presented her draft to the exclusive BIRD group in mid-January. All agreed that the common-sense approach was to release ivermectin. She submitted the protocol to Cochrane for external scientific review. British and Scandinavian scientists founded the Cochrane Collaboration in 1993 to address pharmaceutical industry corruption that had become pervasive in clinical trials for new drugs. Today, the Cochrane Collaboration is a coalition of 30,000 independent scientists and 53 large research institutions who volunteer to routinely review industry data using evidence-based science to advise regulatory agencies. Cochrane seeks to restore integrity and standardized scientific methodologies to the crooked realm of drug development trials. Cochrane uses standardized parameters and rigorous methodologies for evaluating evidence. Cochrane reviewers systematically assess the power of each individual study within the meta-review, interpreting data to identify and discount for bias, and to score each study as high, moderate, or low certainty evidence, and to determine whether it's acceptable to pool the data in a single meta-review. Dr. Lawry knew that to make its ivermectin determination, WHO would rely on Hill's study and another study from McMaster University known as the Together Trial. McMaster was hopelessly and irredeemably conflicted. NIH gave McMaster $1,081,541 in 2020 and 2021. A separate group of McMaster University scientists was, at that time, engaged in developing their own COVID vaccine, an effort that would never pay dividends if WHO recommended ivermectin as standard of care. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was funding the massive Together trial testing ivermectin, HCQ, and other potential drugs against COVID in Brazil and other locations. Critics accuse Gates and the McMaster researchers of designing that study to make ivermectin fail. Among other factors, the study targeted a population that was already heavily utilizing ivermectin, creating a confounding variable placebo recipients could obtain over-the-counter ivermectin that would clearly hide efficacy. McMaster University researchers would certainly know that a positive recommendation for IVM would cost their university hundreds of millions. The Together trial organizer was Gates trial designer Ed Mills, a scientist with heavy conflicts with pharma and a reputation as a notorious industry biostitute. Dr. Lawry knew that the only way to salvage the WHO guidelines and produce a high-quality scientific study was to persuade Mills to do a full-scale Cochrane collaboration meta-analysis. The following week, she spoke to Hill again, this time by Zoom. The Zoom call was recorded. During her first conversation with Hill, Dr. Lawry had concluded that the techniques that Hill employed throughout his meta-review were deeply flawed, and that Hill lacked the experience to perform a systematic review or a meta-analysis. I was surprised he had been given the job. In fact, the transcript of her January 13 conversation suggests that Hill was completely unfamiliar with the requirements of a systematic review, which requires researchers to evaluate and score each study using uniform criteria to assess power and the risk of bias, and to conduct a sensitivity analysis to exclude studies with high risk of bias. This kind of review necessarily judges the reliability of the authors of each participating study. The Cochrane reviewers must be prepared to make harsh judgments about the work quality, integrity, and potential prejudices of each listed co-author of all the studies included in their review, based in part on their individual competence and the financial conflicts of interest potentially affecting each researcher. But Hill, bizarrely, had included the names of all the authors of all of his 7 accumulated studies on the list of the co-authors of his meta-review. That's the equivalent of asking the catcher in a baseball team to also play the umpire, says Dr. Corey. No one with any familiarity with the game would make that mistake. Hill was supposed to be judging these authors. Instead, he treated them as his collaborators. Dr. Lowry gently informed Hill that that was irregular for a meta-analysis, adding, "When you do a systematic review, you usually don't include the authors of the studies because that inherently biases your conclusions. It's got to be independent." Dr. Lowry explained that Hill's paper, in addition to listing as co-authors the researchers whose work he was supposed to be evaluating, makes no pretense of systematically grading evidence according to standardized protocols. "Those deficiencies make it utterly useless," she explained, "for providing clinical guidelines to the WHO. Furthermore, Hill's meta-review looked at only one outcome, the deaths of COVID patients, which was only a small subset of the criteria and endpoints in the studies he had analyzed. She told Hill, "You don't just do a meta-analysis when there's all those other outcomes that you didn't even meta-analyze. You just meta-analyze the death outcome, using only a fraction of the available evidence, and then said, 'Oh, we need more studies.'" Dr. Lowry asked Hill to explain his U-turn on ivermectin, which his own analysis found overwhelmingly effective. "How can you do this?" she inquired politely. "You are causing irreparable harm." Hill explained that he was in a tricky situation because his sponsors had put pressure on him. Hill is a University of Liverpool virologist who serves as an advisor to Bill Gates and the Clinton Foundation. He told me his sponsor was Unitaid. Unitaid is a quasi-governmental advocacy organization funded by the BMGF and several European countries, France, the United Kingdom, Norway, Brazil, Spain, the Republic of Korea, and Chile, to lobby governments to finance the purchase of medicines from pharmaceutical multinationals for distribution to the African poor. Its primary purpose seems to be protecting the patent and intellectual property rights of pharmaceutical companies, which, as we shall see, is the priority passion for Bill Gates, and to ensure their prompt and full payment. About 63% of its funding comes from a surtax on airline tickets. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation holds a board seat and chairs Unitaid's executive committee, and the BMGF has given Unitaid $150 million since 2005. Various Gates-funded surrogate and front organizations, like Global Fund, Gavi, and UNICEF, also contribute, as does the pharmaceutical industry. The BMGF and Gates personally own large stakes in many of the pharmaceutical companies that profit from this boondoggle. Gates also uses Unitaid to fund corrupt science by tame and compromised researchers like Hill that legitimizes his policy directives to the WHO. Unitaid gave $40 million to Andrew Hill's employer, the University of Liverpool, 4 days before the publication of Hill's study. Hill, a PhD, confessed that the sponsors were pressuring him to influence his conclusion. When Dr. Lowry asked who was trying to influence him, Hill said, I think I'm in a very sensitive position here." Dr. Lowry, "Lots of people are in sensitive positions. They're in hospital, in ICUs dying, and they need this medicine." Dr. Hill, "Well..." Dr. Lowry, "This is what I don't get, you know, because you're not a clinician. You're not seeing people dying every day, and this medicine prevents deaths by 80%. So 80% of those people who are dying today don't need to die because there's ivermectin." Dr. Hill, "There are a lot, as I said, there are a lot of different opinions about this. As I say, some people simply..." Dr. Lowry, "We are looking at the data, It doesn't matter what other people say. We are the ones who are tasked with looking at the data and reassuring everybody that this cheap and effective treatment will save lives. It's clear. You don't have to say, well, so-and-so says this and so-and-so says that. It's absolutely crystal clear. We can save lives today if we can get the government to buy ivermectin. Dr. Hill, well, I don't think it's as simple as that because you've got trials. Dr. Lowry, it is as simple as that. We don't have to wait for studies. We have enough evidence now that shows that ivermectin saves lives. It prevents hospitalization. It saves the clinical staff going to work every day and being exposed. And frankly, I'm shocked at how you are not taking responsibility for that decision. And you still haven't told me who is influencing you, who is giving you that opinion, because you keep saying you're in a sensitive position. I appreciate you are in a sensitive position. If you're being paid for something and you're being told to support a certain narrative, that is a sensitive position. So then you kind of have to decide, well, do I take this payment? Because in actual fact, you can see your false conclusions are going to harm people. So maybe you need to say, I'm not going to be paid for this. I can see the evidence, and I will join the Cochrane team as a volunteer like everybody on the Cochrane team is a volunteer. Nobody's being paid for this work.